And welcome to Find, Tell, Share, the Storytellers Podcast. Stories for entrepreneurs and artists who share their stories as we discuss everything storytelling. I'm Gemma Rosenthal and this is my co-host.
I'm Chris Sissons. On today's show, we explore marketing automation, email copywriting, Yorkshire dialect, and writing and sketching.
And this time, we're delighted to introduce our guest, Rob Drummond. Rob is an email copywriter and marketing automation consultant based in Sheffield. He runs Story Copywriters, where he helps coaches and consultants to attract a steady stream of income. Ideal clients by telling their story. But I'm sure income as well comes with ideal clients. Hi, hopefully. Rob.
Hi, Gemma. Hi, Chris. Great to be here.
Hello.
Great to have you on the podcast. So I've been looking at your website and I see that you have a book called Simple Story Selling. So what made you come up with that title?
Well, I think I've always been interested in storytelling as a kind of core facet of communication and how do we build trust. And, you know, I think my work has kind of gone around in circles a little bit over the years. Like, I started out as a web designer, which is how I met Chris. And then I've been in Google Ads. But like, the question at the heart of my work really has been, how do we build trust authentically with people that we've just met who really could benefit from our services but don't yet trust us? And I think storytelling is one of the ways of doing that. So over the last, you know, 5 to 8 years or so, I've really been kind of exploring story. I mean, I don't think anyone can own story. It just is like something that humans do. I think we are, you know, natural storytellers. And on my journey to that, a friend and client recommended that I read Christopher Booker's epic tome, The Seven Basic Plots. And I really wanted to see, you know, could I, well, I'd say firstly, that book, it impacted me quite a lot. But then I wanted to see, well, could I apply seven plots to business storytelling? Was there an application for people who are trying to build trust with an audience, come across authentically as their real selves? Could we apply some of these plots as a way of beating the blank screen? Because, you know, when you go off to write a story and your story is a massive, messy thing, could we use this as a framework to kind of get going, but tell an archetypal story that communicates something authentically, but leverages the lessons of great literature? And that's really what I set out to do with the book. So the book is story selling because it is ultimately still about selling. It's about selling high value products and services to people who really need those services, but where this sale is underpinned by trust and trust in you as a service provider. So yeah, so story selling was kind of the theme. And I was like, well, I'm trying to make it as simple as possible. I'm trying to make it as foolproof as possible for busy business owners who, you know, maybe don't want to master every element of storytelling, but, you know, need to grapple with the basics to get going, to build a bigger audience, to scale the impact that their work has on the world.
Yeah. So what do you think it is about? I've got two questions from that, because I also want to ask about the basic plots, the seven basic plots. But first of all, what do you think it is about storytelling that builds trust?
Well, I think we all have the picture reels rolling in our heads, and we actually navigate. I think we navigate our lives through story. You know, when I get home this evening, my wife will ask me what I did today. I'll say I was interviewed by a podcast, and inadvertently, we're always telling stories. We're always working from a mental narrative about how the world is and how the world works. So I think when we tell stories, you kind of take the reader or the listener out of the kind of logical world and into the realm of imagination. It's where emotions live. And really what we're doing is we're enabling the person who is listening to the story to imagine being on our shoes and feel our emotions. And it's by feeling those emotions that I think lays the foundation for trust. Obviously, you can communicate rationally with all of the arguments and the logic as to why someone should trust you, but until they feel that by having been in your shoes, by having lived in the situations that you have been through and presumably you're, you know, in some respects on the same path that they are on, and you face some of the same challenges, then I think story is the best way of doing that, because it does so at a at an emotional level. Mm-hmm. And I still think you want the rational arguments, the features and the benefits, but they don't belong at the point at which you first met someone, you're trying to build trust with them, you're trying to attract them deeper into your world. I think the other thing for me is that telling your story communicates your core values, so that if someone listens to your story, it has this kind of attraction and repulsion mechanism where the people who share your values go instantly recognize that you are what they have been searching for. Mm-hmm. And the people who don't share your values kind of go, well, yeah, that isn't really what I want. So it has the dual facet of attracting ideal clients who you really want to work with, who are a joy to work with, who pay you well. And it also repels the nightmare clients, which I think is equally important.
Yeah, definitely. Because you want to work with people. Well, most people want to work with people that they enjoy working with. So that's really important as well. So can you explain the 7 basic plots? And I know it's from a book that you mentioned.
Yes. So Christopher Booker wrote the 7 basic plots over about 30 years. And he analyzes all sorts of literature going back to the Epic of Gilgamesh, going back thousands of years to the beginning of written storytelling. And he asks, what patterns do they follow? Can they be categorized in a consistent way? And what he says is that there's 2 types of stories. There's an archetypal story. An archetypal story essentially never goes out of date because the lessons it teaches are evergreen. The other type of story is a stereotypical story. So if you were in Spain and you were to create, say, a television production about life in the Basque country, then that is based on a stereotype, and that will resonate to people in the Basque country who lived through that period of life. But it won't necessarily resonate to me, you, and Chris in Sheffield, because we won't understand the references to that particular culture. And he was trying to figure out, well, some of these stories have really lasted. Some of these stories are revered. Some of these stories are retold. So the story of Snow White is told dozens and lots and lots of different ways across a wide range of time. But it's the structure that causes it to have longevity. So he analyzes all of these stories, all of the stories that he considers plot archetypes. And he says, well, what are the commonalities? And essentially what he says is that they all follow this same pattern. They all follow the pattern that might be called the hero's journey, where you've got in an archetype story, you're more likely to have a single protagonist, and the story is about the internal change that protagonist goes from the start to the end. So you have the character arc where the character changes in some fundamental way, and the role of the story is to illustrate that change. And he kind of identified that all of these plots have the same pattern. So we have this sort of call or anticipation phase at the start. We have the dream phase where things seem to go quite well for the protagonist. We then have the nightmare stage where the wheels fall off the bus and things start to go wrong. We eventually, that culminates in the climax or the final ordeal. And then eventually you have the resolution stage. And what he says is that he identified 7 plots, and some of them are going to escape me now, but he talks about rags to riches being one common type of plot. He talks about overcoming the monster being one type of plot. He talks about rebirth being one of the common types of plot. And what he says, he also talks about tragedy and comedy, which are quite broad. And he says, these tragedy and comedy in particular, has multiple kind of facets within it, but it still follows the same overall pattern. And what he says is that each of these plot types follows the same structure. It just kind of looks at the hero's journey from a different perspective. So in the tragedy plot, for instance, the protagonist, the dark energy or the dark force in the story is also contained within the protagonist. So in the end, you don't get the happy ending because the protagonist dies. So in Macbeth obviously doesn't survive the story, but the Kingdom of Scotland returns to its natural state in the end, and that's where we get the resolution. but it's the same. It's the same lessons. It's the same structure. So that really caught my attention, because always in my work, I'm looking for principles. I'm always trying to peel back, especially in marketing, where new tools, new techniques crop up all of the time. If something has been around for thousands of years, that's something that's going to get my attention. I was like, well, if this has worked in literature for thousands of years, and people spend, you know, a huge amount of hours consuming movies, reading books, there's obviously a principle in this that we can apply, that we can use. So the question behind my work has always been, well, how can we apply this? And that's what I try to address in the book. Is I analyze. So I think at the start of about 2016, I sent an email to my email list and said, look, I'm going to send you an email, one a day, where I'm going to write a story about each plot. And I just wanted to see, for me, which stories felt kind of delivered my core message in the best way, and which ones felt a bit forced. So I got to, like, the tragedy plot, for instance, and I didn't actually have a personal story that I felt accurately reflected the tragedy plot. So I told a client's story. I had a client at the time who taught mountain guides, and he had a lot of tragedy stories about people who have fallen off the faces of mountains. But in telling those stories, there's a warning to people who are thinking about becoming a mountain guide. So I told one of his stories. So I told an archetypal story each day for 7 days. And for me, there were definitely some plots that I felt were more usable from a business perspective than others. And in working through this with clients since, I've kind of reflected that most often we kind of gravitate to rebirth. So if you think about a rebirth plot, Scrooge is maybe the classic rebirth plot, where partly through the story, Scrooge has to go and see the three ghosts, and he has this fundamental character change where he is taken out of this frozen state of darkness and reborn with new purpose and new life. And actually, I mostly work with coaches and consultants, and these coaches and consultants, their life trajectory hasn't all been happiness and joy. They've normally had this kind of central crisis, if you like. So the beauty of the rebirth plot is it allows you to explore this central crisis, but then it communicates to the reader how you've come out of it, how it's shaped your purpose going forwards. So it's very usable from a business perspective. There were some plots I thought kind of are useful, but more in a supportive capacity. So the comedy plot, for instance, you can use quite well, because the comedy plot's always about a misunderstanding about roles and a misunderstanding about people's real identities. So I tell the story in my email series about a time where I was working with a client. I was managing the client's Google Ads account, and he eventually came back to me and said, oh, I've hired this email copywriter. And I went back to him and said, you do understand that I do email copywriting? And then the situation got worse. We had the nightmare stage where this copywriter eventually produced this email series, which is absolute garbage. And we had this eventual, you know, climactic moment where he said, right, okay, Rob, I need you to come in and save me, write the emails. And eventually it resolved, but it was all about the misunderstanding about people's true identities. So you can use stuff like comedy. I think it plays more of a supporting role, because another question that I'm always asking is, like, when people first come across you and your work, what story do you lead with? Because you only get to tell one story. You can't tell the whole thing. You only get to tell one slice. So that slice has to do the best job of reaching people at an emotional level. So it should be, if you're going to select a plot archetype, which I think is a good model, it's a good framework. I mean, ultimately, this is just it's almost a story selection framework. Which of those is the best one to select? And I'd say that often we're telling, you know, rags to riches stories, we're telling rebirth stories. Often later on in the customer journey, when people have been subscribed for a little bit, we might introduce an overcoming the monster story. Perhaps you had an old boss in the past who, you know, was out to get you, and you can tell an overcoming the monster story about that. You know, you might introduce comedy, you might introduce tragedy. But yeah, that's kind of the gist of where I've been going with the work. But yeah, I've seen great results, both in terms of within my own business in terms of placing stories in key places, because, you know, you can kind of gauge this just in terms of the feedback that you get when you tell the story. You know, either if you're telling the story by email, what replies do you get to that email? And you can always ask for a reply to kind of gauge that. Possibly a better way of doing it is to jump on a podcast or to go to a networking meeting and try telling an Overcoming the Monster story, try telling a Rebirth story, try telling a Rags to Riches story. See which ones, you know, resonate with a live audience, and then automate that in an email sequence.
Yeah, that's really good. Chris, do you have any thoughts around this topic around, because I know you've told me about the 7 basic plots before. Have you got anything to add from what Rob has said?
I've stumbled on Christopher Booker, the bookshop, a few years ago and read it. Yeah, it's interesting. I tend to use the Rebirth stories as little as possible, not because I don't like it, but because I think it's a very powerful story. And I think when I'm not sure whether I differ from Rob on this or not, but Rob can come back at me. The thing about the Rebirth story is, like the tragedy, the protagonist makes a mistaken decision at the beginning of the story that seems to go well for a while, and then the wheel. But instead of the wheels falling off with the Rebirth story, the protagonist goes into a state of stasis. Nothing happens for decades. It's just, and a number of stories you get where somebody took up a job. I think the latest one I heard was somebody who worked with the railways for several, you know, 2 or 3 decades before finding her real vocation. And it's that that long period, I mean, it may have had its joys and its triumphs within it, but it was a period when that person wasn't really expressing their full self.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a very human story, because I think most people don't really find their vocation until we get into our 30s, 40s, 50s. So I think it's relatable on that sense, in that we've been through periods of our life where we felt stuck. We've not quite had the clarity as to what we're doing. I think it's definitely related to the tragedy plots. It's the same, it's very much the same structure. It's really only the kind of crisis point and beyond that differs. I wouldn't say I use it all the time, but I think for telling a powerful story about how someone has uncovered their purpose and how that relates to the customer, we found it to be quite useful.
It comes up, or potentially comes up, quite a bit. I like to just sort of explore around the story a bit more before I sort of commit to that particular. And of course, you can tell the same story using different plot structures.
Yeah.
Not necessarily all 7.
Well, the Lord of the Rings is the classic example of a story that uses all 7 plots. And you do see multiple plots in action embedded within each other in literature. But often for business storytelling, that use case doesn't quite exist.
Yeah, well, you can tell you can tell the same story, but use a different plot structure.
Yeah.
So you that means you're not getting something that's sort of far too long.
Yeah.
although being far too long is a common problem.
I'm trying to work out what plot lines I've used in the various books that I've been in, because I know Chris worked with me on The New Woman, so I had a chapter called Dancing with a Voice, and we sort of started off in that. I suppose you start off in the tragedy thing of like, oh, everything's going wrong, I thought I'd be further along in life than I am, that kind of mindset. And then it's like I get a call. It's like, will you do this performance for this thing? And it's like, oh, can I do it? Can I not do it? And then but then I jumped back in time to where the even more tragedy is happening. So it kind of like, but then it gets to the end and it is a kind of rebirth thing in terms of, I do the performance, it goes well. I found my voice, ta-da-da. But I didn't, it kind of like, because I was working as a dance teacher for quite a long time before I was putting my songs out there, and I was kind of putting songs here and there. I was doing a few performance singing, but mainly I was working in dance, which I love dancing. So it's always a confusing thing when people ask me, oh, you did dance teaching, you must love that. And I go, yeah, I do. I love it. And also, because my business is all centered around finding your voice. And when you have you may be talented in one area and that's kind of like where you might be working. And then people assume that that's your purpose because you're working in it. And then, so it's kind of like what I'm helping clients to do is finding their voice, as in what they feel passionate about in their whole self. So not just one aspect, where, you know, they might've been boxed in into that just because of circumstances, which was the case for me as well. It's kind of like, okay, so if you feel like you're a songwriter and that's what you do and you know that's who you are, then that's the path I'm now following, where I use my dancing but I also do my songwriting and coach others to do that as well. So I don't know how that fits into the
no it does part. It does, because often our work isn't necessarily going to be what you might regard as your passion, and maybe there's an overlap between the two. Perhaps there's a kind of Venn diagram between your trade and what you do to get paid, and then there's an overlap between your voice and your passions, and hopefully they overlap to some degree.
Oh yeah.
You know, to some people the overlap might be quite a lot. To some people it kind of maybe just overlaps a slight bit. But I think, you know, you can still tell stories about the dancing, because telling the stories about the dancing allows you to explore the human contradictions of, yes, you enjoy it, yes, you enjoy it for these reasons, but it's not maybe not part of your authentic voice in some other ways, and it allows you to kind of explore that.
Yeah, I mean, it was so, I mean, the thing I most enjoyed about dance teaching was when the kids came up with their own ideas. So there's some stories that I could tell where I started the music and then they were all at the back and they were supposed to be at the front, but then they ran to the front and I went, yes, use that, do that. That looks great. Cause it just brought the energy at the beginning. And I thought, yeah, that's a really good start actually, but it was a mistake. It wasn't supposed to be
at
the start, but those are the kind of moments that I remember, because that's the creativity and that's what I am passionate about. So even if it's just, even if someone said, you're a singer-songwriter and that's what you do, that wouldn't even really actually say my purpose either, because I think my purpose is around the creative life force, that creativity, that joy, that spark, and however you can get that, that's what excites me, is when I can support either doing it myself through my own work, or if I can support someone else to do that, and sort of they get these flashlights of, oh yeah, I could do that, or yeah, oh, I've got an idea for a song, and they start writing it, or oh yeah, I could do this move here and that works, and that's what I find joyful. So it is interesting, those contradictions, like you said, in some jobs or situations that we have where we enjoy certain parts of it, and it's trying to work out, why is it that I enjoy that part of it? What is it about that? Because even like when I was working in shops, which was nothing to do with performing, but there were still elements of the day where it was like, yeah, I'm really enjoying this. Why is it that I'm enjoying it? Oh, it's because I'm chatting with people and I'm asking them questions and I enjoy working with people. So it's working out what part of the job do you enjoy and what don't you enjoy. And again, it's like following your bliss and following those parts that you do enjoy.
I think very few people get to the point where their vocation is their kind of life's work. And it's very nice if you can get to that point. I mean, I read the Leo Tolstoy even wrote about this at length, where he lamented the fact that he was very poorly paid for what he did at the time, and a lot of his success came actually after his death. And he he's written very eloquently about the challenges of the artist to both produce work that is true to their heart, but then also be paid for it live in real time, not necessarily after you're dead.
What's this guy's name?
Tolstoy.
War and Peace.
Anna
Karenina.
Yeah. But yeah, he wrote some nonfiction as well.
I think it might be an idea to go on to Rob's story.
So yeah, into your story now, Rob. Off you go.
So in 2009, I spent 6 months traveling in South America. And right at the end of my trip, I was traveling in Colombia with two friends that I'd met while I was there. And we were traveling from... we were traveling to the city of Santa Marta on the Caribbean coast, where we were going to do a 3-day hike from the coast through low jungle to a place called the Lost City. It's called La Ciudad Perdida, which was a civilization, a pre-Columbian civilization called the Tairona civilization. So you do this 3-day hike through the jungle. It's quite remote. You camp out on site at the former capital of this civilization, and then you hike back. This was right before I flew back. It was the grand finale of the trip. And I was traveling from Cartagena to Santa Marta on a bus with my two companions. Really hot day, really beautiful scenery outside. I'd relaxed. The bus was busy. There was children running around. I'd unclipped my belt and I'd spread my things out a bit. Halfway, we passed a city called Barranquilla, and a guard came on in kind of khaki uniform and said, "Oh, cambio, 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 change buses." So everyone groans and then sort of panics to grab stuff. So we grabbed all our stuff. We got off the bus. I could see the bus driving away. I pat my tummy where my money belt usually is. So my money belt contains my passport, my credit cards, all of my money, basically my life, and it's not there. And in the hurry to get off, I realized I had this sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach that I've left it on the bus. I can see the bus traveling away. The next bus is here. We go and speak to the bus conductor, a young lady, and we explain to her in stuttering, broken Spanish what's happened. And she says, "Sube, get on. We'll make some phone calls for you," all in Spanish. So I pause for a moment and weigh up. Should I try and chase this bus? Should I get on the bus to Santa Marta? We decide to get on the bus. This bus is cooler. It has more space. I sit there with my two companions. It's about another 2 hours to Santa Marta. Everyone else in the bus is feeling jovial. I'm just staring out the window, looking at the coastline going past, thinking that every second that passes, I'm traveling further and further away from my passport, away from my belt. And that when I get to Santa Marta, I'm going to have to just borrow some money off my friends, get a bus back to Bogota, go to the embassy, beg for a passport, hope that they give me a passport in time for my flight. And I'm sitting there and, you know, there's some children on the bus. There's a lady at the back of the bus who's got a chicken in a cage. Everyone's talking in rapid fire Spanish. I don't want to talk to anyone. I don't even want to talk to my companions. The sun starts to go down and the bus gets quieter and quieter as we approach the Santa Marta bus terminal. Eventually we pull in at the terminal. Everyone else gets off. I say to my companions, "Right, guys, I think it's time to go. And the bus conductor comes up to me and she says, "Espera, por favor, wait." She disappears for a few minutes. The driver switched off the engine at this point. She then reappears. She's got my money belt. I'm stunned. I give her the biggest hug you can imagine. And she says that they made some phone calls. Another bus company had searched a bus that I had been on, found my money belt, put it on another bus to Santa Marta, and they got it back to me that night. And while I was in South America, I heard all of these stories about people being robbed, especially in Colombia, people being robbed at gunpoint. But it made me reflect that, you know, being robbed and receiving extreme levels of trust were never actually very far away.
That's great.
Oh, thank you. I'm assuming that's the end of the story. Yeah. So I actually had a similar thing happen to me the other day. I left some shopping on the bus and got off, left it, and I did manage to get it back. I was waiting. I had to go across the road and then wait. So immediately as you were telling the story, I was in your shoes. Absolutely. And because yours was like your money bag as well, it was just like, oh my God, you know, I felt anxiety as you were saying it. And I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Yeah. So it's amazing how it does put you in, you know, in the person's shoes.
And that's the thing. I think it's quite a relatable story, because even if you've never been like traveling in Colombia, like we've all been on a bus and like left something valuable on a bus and had to face the consequences of it. And then you decide what to do. So the pressure is put on you as the kind of protagonist, and then you're forced into a decision and you have to live by the consequences.
It happens less as you get older, because you become more paranoid.
I was pretty paranoid in South America. I mean, I was really careful.
I think just a couple of things about the story. I'm trying to work out which of the seven basic story types it is. My vote is for comedy.
Yes, it's. I would say so. I'm not sure it actually is a plot archetype as such. Well, the plot archetypes are kind of, I would say. Yeah. I mean, it focuses around a mistake and a decision point, and then what I did as a result of that, and you know, putting my faith in someone else to hold my trip together, basically.
Put your faith in it. You didn't really expect the money belt to come back.
I didn't expect it to come back, but we did get on the bus.
That was
the decision point.
Balance. But the other thing I wanted to highlight about the story, or two things, is your use of emotion and detail. In terms of emotion, I mean, for example, you talk about that sinking feeling when you realise it had gone away. We all know that in the pit of your stomach.
The lead feeling where the penny of realisation drops.
And then staring out of the window, not communicating with the people around you. And then the response when she says, wait, the engine switches off. That's possibly a detail. And then she produces the money belt and you hug her. That's another expression of emotion. Mm. So that there's a thread of emotion going through the story. And I think the detail is also important, because this is taking place in Colombia, where none of us have been. So it helps the story just a little bit to evoke what it's like. Now, I don't know how many times you've been on a bus in Sheffield, Gemma, and had a woman in the back with a chicken in the cage. Presumably it's an everyday event in Colombia. who knows? But that just, you don't need a colossal amount of detail to evoke the place, but you need some.
You're just selecting a few details to help paint the picture in the listener's mind, I think. Not describe the whole situation, just a few personal ones.
It's also, you know, the fact that you had to communicate in Spanish and then they were communicating in Spanish. I don't know how much Spanish you know, but obviously that makes you think, oh God, it's an even more anxiety-producing situation, because you're not in your own language, you know what I mean? You're not, and you're in a different country as well. So even though if it happened here, you'd still feel those emotions.
It would be a different story, or maybe not even a story.
Yeah.
Because the language barrier builds the tension in the story, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
it's the fact that I'm in a remote place, and then if I was elaborating on the story, it would probably add to the kind of degree of internal conflict afterwards, because I was kind of reflecting, like, have I communicated this properly to her? Like, she said she was going to make some phone calls. At no point did I actually see her on the phone. But she clearly did. I just didn't see it. But, you know, I could elaborate on that. I could elaborate on how she was just sitting there chatting to other passengers.
Yeah. It's giving me an idea, because I'm like, I do now, I can see that what happened to me the other day is actually a story, because it led me to go to, I had to charge my phone because my phone was going down as I was, so I was waiting for this bus and then my phone started going down. I was like, oh my God, I need, and I was so cold as well. So then I went into an Indian restaurant and they said I could charge my phone. And then I realized, I was like, oh, I better buy something, but then I've got to go and get my thing. So then I came back and ended up meeting a photographer who was doing the taking pictures of the food, and it was a really great conversation, and you know, we swapped details after. So if I want to have some photos done, I can get some, you know, photos. But it's like
you only ended up in that situation because
I only ended up in that situation because I left my bag. Yeah. And I think it's like, you know, but I wouldn't have realized that's a story. Do you understand what I mean?
I
know it is, but, and I've told it a couple of people already that were, you know, on the day. But like,
I think there has to be stakes in it though for people to really resonate with it. So the reason I saw the money belt story is because the stakes were quite high. We were doing this trek. I described the trek in quite a lot of detail at the start and how it was the finale of the trip. And the repercussions of having to travel to Bogota, beg for a passport, you know, the stakes are quite high.
Yeah.
So I was telling without going in too much detail, I was telling another story another day about a time I was almost mugged in Sheffield as a student.
Mm.
And I was thinking that, well, actually, I could have even raised the stakes even more by saying, you know, I had an exam the next day, I was rushing home to finish, you know, my revision, or I had an essay deadline the next day. I had 2,000 words still to write. I was rushing home. I then get accosted by this young chap who asks me to hand my phone over. There's things I could have done to raise the stakes and kind of make the reader think.
Yeah, it's a distinction between realizing that you have a story and realizing the story, because you. It's
getting the details.
You've got to, you know, you left your bag on a bus, and then the aftermath of that, and the Indian restaurant and everything. So that,
okay, it was
So you're now beginning to add detail, but this is what I'm saying. This is the difference between find and tell. Finding is.
How am I going to tell it so that I can raise
the stakes, so that I can capture and hold attention, you know, and maybe also promote my business.
So in terms of your, you were going
to
say something.
Yeah, so to me, you leaving your bag, that is the thing that puts pressure on you to make a decision. And then it's about what do you do? So you ended up in this Indian restaurant. That's then what, that was your decision then. So then it's how that pans out. But it, you know, the fact that you left a bag on a bus is just the thing that puts pressure on you, I think. And there has to be pressure. I only knew
how to get to the other side of the road to wait for the bus, because after I got off the bus, there was all these people around. So I just said to them, oh, I've left my bag on the bus. And they were all trying to help me so they said, oh, you can actually go across the other road and it'll come back round, because it was one, you know, like a bus. But I didn't realise how long that was going to take. So I was waiting for about an hour, and obviously you get really cold. But I think the bit about the story that I like is kind of, you know, because these things happen to me often where I'll leave something or there's a delay, and these things could happen, and you could just go into that kind of mindset of, oh, I hate life, these horrible things happen. But if you actually go back to the trust thing, it's like that ability to trust other people and go, it's okay, you know, they're going to help me sort this out. You know, even if you don't know that for sure, it's that ability to trust. And I think that's what your story is also about, that kind of like, okay, this has happened, but I've got to trust that it will either sort itself out or it won't. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I deliberately finished the story by talking about trust, because that's what I want. That was the idea I wanted to impart that it was about. But I could have finished by saying that it was about bravery. It was about was about some other idea, and that, I mean, it might still have been that trust came across, but generally the story is about whatever you kind of finish it on. So, well, you can almost guide the reader or the listener.
I'd almost say mine's about opportunity and possibility. Mm. So the creative mindset is always about how can I make this work for me? Not just for you, but for other people as well. So it's kind of like, oh, I networked at the end of it. I had a meal, and then I met a nice person, and you know, might be able to work together at some point. Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of like one of the things around, that being the creative possibilities that can come out of any situation. Mm. Even telling this story here, and you telling it, you know, your story. It's having that mindset as the thing is happening as well. Mm. So it's like reminding yourself, oh yeah, this could be a story, or this could be a possibility to meet some new people, or you know, that kind of
thing. Yeah, these things happen to us all the time, and it's a case of, I'm always trying to get my students to kind of store these ideas. So I try to get people to store them however you want to store them. So I use Evernote for logging and organizing ideas, but it could just be making notes on your phone or however you want to do it. But if you don't capture it at the time, it's very hard to reuse it later on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, Chris is going to introduce another story that we have on the podcast today.
Yes,
you've got
getting
two stories,
money's worth this
so,
time. I recently was given two walking poles, and the official reason why you use walking poles is so that while you're walking, you exercise your upper body. The real reason that you have walking poles is to reduce the chance of falling over. And I'm learning to negotiate. Getting over a stile with two walking poles is a challenge in three-dimensional geometry beyond my comprehension just at the moment. But it certainly helps when you're out in the hills. And one of the green walking pole is called Donald, and the blue walking pole is called Josie. Donald and Josie are old friends. I must have met them about 30 years ago, and we went to the same church, we'd been friends for all those years, and Donald died between 5 and 10 years ago now. And Josie's still going strong. And I was hoping to invite Josie as a guest on the podcast. But recently, Josie has published a CD of stories in Yorkshire dialect. The dialect that she uses is technically West Yorkshire, but it's similar to the dialect in Sheffield. And she was 91. When she recorded these stories. And you can tell when you listen that Josie, in her time, was an announcer on BBC Radio Sheffield and has a lot of experience in that sort of area. And the stories are lovely. We're going to play one of those stories called Granny's Proposal to give you a flavour. And after that, we'll see what the two of you think. So here's the story, Josie Smith telling the story of Granny's Proposal.
This next one came to me straight from the horse's mouth. I've taken liberties with the language because neither of the participants actually spoke in dialect, but I'm sure you'll forgive me. The story sounds better this way, I think. Me grandmother, that's me mother's mother, were a well-set-up woman, a and a widow with her own little house. And she were a good cook and all. There were not much wrong with her except her blood pressure and what she called her various veins. But one year, her knees were playing up a bit with sciatics. So me and my mother, you'd go and do a bit of gardening for her on a Wednesday afternoon. I were nobbit a little un in them days, and allus used to car quiet with me own bit of weeding to do and listening to what were going on. This particular day, me granny seemed a bit excited-like. And when they'd gone over old family news and me mother had finished cutting grass, they stopped for a cup of tea and a glass of milk for me with one of me granny's ginger biscuits. "You'll never credit what happened to me a Sunday," granny suddenly come out with. "What were it?" said me mother. Granny were allus a bit of a drama queen, and she could tell a rape tale when it suited her. "I got a proposal." "You what?" said me mother, thinking her ears were deceiving her. "Aye," granny said, "this old chap as goes to our chapel walked home with me on Sunday morning. It were a bit drizzly, and he offered to share his umbrella. I thought it were right gentlemanly of him. But then when we were walking up our road, he stops all of a sudden and says, 'Can I ask you summat?' I thought he'd been taken short and wanted to use me lavatory. Old chaps has a bit of a problem in that department. But no, he said as how he'd been on his own since his wife died, and he'd been looking at me at chapel for a long time. He had a bit but by and no family, so what did I think?" "What did I think about what?" I said. And he said, "I want thee to wed me." "Nay," I told him, "we're a bit old for that sort of thing." On her road, she'd said to me mother, "I couldn't be bothered at my time of life. His name's Onions and all, and I couldn't stand being called Mrs. Onions."
So the reason why I chose this story, because I was listening to, you know, the whole of her CD, and I just thought the way she said it, you know, obviously it's short and sweet for the podcast, but also it's just, there was just so much lightness and comedy in it. So I think out of the seven plots, I'm guessing it would be a comedy.
Definitely a comedy. just pay attention to the ending. So, well, I couldn't marry him. I'd be called Mrs. Onions.
Yeah, and I think we can all relate to granny stories. Well, I'm guessing most of us have grandparents at some point, and obviously some of us don't know them when they're alive. But for those that do, or even those who just know of an older lady, may be able to relate to this story. And I just think she says it in such a fun way, and yeah
the dialogue works, doesn't it?
Yes, using dialogue in it.
I think it's interesting as well that, because she says that the story wasn't originally dialogue, so she's kind of adapted it into dialogue. So just because I don't think you necessarily have to tell a story literally the way it happened, I think it's okay to apply a degree of creativity to make the story more impactful. Like, yes, it's maybe bending the literal truth, but Personally, I think it's okay.
Yeah, well, we have this debate sometimes, don't we, Chris, around truth and how to tell stories and how much creative license to use, especially if you're looking for that trust. It is a difficult one because you don't want to go too far off the...
There's a balance, I think. I think there's somewhere... Because ultimately, like, you don't want to tell boring stories that don't have... that have low stakes, that... where you're just droning on and people are trying to kind of get away from you. Like, so you don't want to be like that. But, you know, equally, we're not trying to make stuff up. I mean, unless you're setting out to write fiction.
This is the joy of telling a story live. I know it's recorded on a CD, as it's set in that way. But Josie could have chosen to simply tell the story as her grandmother told it. It was raining, and I went from church and shared an umbrella with Mr. Onions and so on and so forth. But what she actually does is she sets that story inside another story of as a child gardening.
Yes, I kind of felt there were two. My initial response was that there were two threads going on, but then I realised that it's, as you said, that one is set inside the other. But initially, I thought the story was going to be to do with her as a child gardening in the garden. But then you realise that you're kind of eavesdropping on a conversation, and it's that's the real story that's going on.
You know, putting a child in a story is always a good move because it lightens the story. And again, you get the little bits of detail, you know, the glass of milk and the ginger biscuit. And you can hear Granny going on about old men's waterworks. I thought he just needed to use the lavatory when he stopped.
I think the story could potentially be split into two. Like, you could tell a story about working in Granny's garden and elaborate on the ginger cookie and have some kind of story that branches off that way. And you could tell the story about Granny's proposal separately. Like, it would theoretically, I mean, it's fine the way it was told, but like, it would be possible to split those into two separate
things. In a way, they are two separate things. And this is one of the ways in which you move from finding stories to telling stories. Because sometimes you've got two stories, and at first you don't realise that they're linked. And then suddenly you see, oh, actually, when you put them together, you've got something that's more than the two parts.
I think it depends on how you're telling the story as well. Like, if you're recording a CD of anecdotes from your life, then I think the way that was told was absolutely fine. If I had a client who was telling a story to place in a business communication, it would be quite a big red flag. I'd say, look, we need to just pick one of these and just focus on one. So I think it perhaps depends on the output that you've got.
I think that raises another question, which is what's the difference between a story told for entertainment purposes and a story that's told for selling purposes? And they both need work. They both need to be told in a, you know, it's not just about, you know, the sort of raw story you might tell your wife when you get home after a day out, you know, about something that happened in the day out. They're both stories that are being worked on, but they're worked on in different ways for different purposes.
And they both should entertain. That's the first rule of all good storytelling, I think.
Would one of the differences be that a story for selling needs to have almost a call for action at the end? So something that, not always, but often it might be that you want to link it to something that you do.
Yeah, normally you're trying to lead to a single idea. You're trying to lead people to a single idea, and that single idea could connect to a call to action. Or it might not. It might be that you're just setting the groundwork for a call to action that's going to come later.
Yeah, because you don't always want to be selling something at the end, because then people don't always like that.
There's different schools of thought on this. So some people that I know who send regular emails and tell stories will literally put a call to action at the end of every email. Perry Marshall being one at the moment that I subscribe to. My school of thought is more to have regular communications, but then to have a specific promotional window where you have a period of time where you're promoting a particular offer, and then that window closes. It has a deadline, it has scarcity around it, and then it's closed for a while. It's like the train leaving the station. You know, people run to get on trains before the train departs. And then the train departs, and you have to wait for the next one. So that's more my preferred approach. But I've seen people do it both ways. So
So I think we're going on to the end part of the my section, and then we'll finish the podcast. But if you've been listening so far, thank you. And this bit is going to be about how we can create our, how do we create our stories? So as a Christmas present this year, I got a sketchbook challenge book, and it has little ideas each day that you can do for sketching. So you can just do things like patterns, or you get an object and you draw it. But the idea is that you do it, you create a habit. So they talk about in the book, I'll see if I can get the link for the book under the podcast. But the idea is that you do a little bit every day. It doesn't have to be a full picture, a full, you know, creation of art. It's just about practice and about putting pen to paper, or, you know, paintbrush to paper. And this got me thinking about also writing, or if you're doing, you know, speaking and storytelling, and how do you create that practice for yourself? So I know for me, I've read Julia Cameron's books and The Artist's Way. And one of her ideas is that you do morning pages, which is just getting it out on the page. It doesn't have to be a story. It doesn't even have to make sense. It can just be about the fact that, oh, I've got some washing to do today and I need to put the trash out or something. Like, it can literally be that. And, oh, it's raining outside and, you know, feeling a bit cold today. Yeah, it can just be whatever's going on. But I found this practice really helpful to just gain clarity around just life in general. And then when I do come to write a story or speak, there's just something that it allows you to be more creative, because you've already done that practice every single day. And it's the same with the songwriting as well. If I just go to the piano, you know, daily, or it doesn't have to be the piano, it could just be that I sing daily, you know, I do some scales or something, the best I can. It doesn't have to be daily, it could be, you know, 3 times a week or even once a week, but it's just getting that regular practice in. So I just wanted to know your thoughts on this, Rob and Chris, around what's your kind of practice, or do you have a practice? And what are your thoughts around that idea of just doing it daily or weekly or whatever, to just get stuff out?
Yeah, I have a variation of the morning pages idea there. So I've tried that and I found that it doesn't actually work that well for me. But what I do instead is I maintain a day a page diary. That's an A5 diary. And I actually write in mine before I go to bed. I write a log of what I've done that day, what interactions are meaningful. Was there a single moment that brought me joy? Whether that was just like watching the kids wave at the bin lorry driver, or watching my 4-year-old draw letters on the Etch-a-Sketch. What was the one thing that stuck in my mind? I'll jot down stuff like that. Because I realized a few years ago that I was kind of drifting through life without really documenting it almost. And sometimes it's like, well, you kind of get to the end and you've done all of these things. You've been busy in day-to-day life. But it's like, well, you kind of forget all of these details. So I use that. And then when I come across a page that I feel has been particularly useful, because a lot of them aren't. A lot of them are just, I went to work, I did this. I went for a run at lunch, it rained on me. But sometimes when I get to a page where there is some kind of element of joy, some kind of, and it kind of teaches me as well to kind of throughout the day to be looking out for things that are amazing, but we are blind to them because of everyday existence. And it could be, you know, in autumn or spring, it could be a double rainbow on the horizon, or I'm quite conscious at the moment of the changing light So, you know, really from mid, you know, the second week of February, like you really notice the light changing and the daffodils show up, and I'll write about stuff like that as well. But if there's a day where I feel like it's been particularly useful, I'll take a photo of it and I'll add that photo to my Evernote in a special folder. Often those stories then end up in my published writing. Often, not always, but it's kind of a curated selection. But so I'll write initially freehand using pen and paper. I think that's quite important. I've tried it on my phone. I think writing it with pen and paper is completely different. I think it uses a different part of your brain. So I definitely use pen and paper. Mm-hmm. Like it's like you're recording it analog before you digitize it. Yeah. Another thing I'm doing is then, so I've been doing this since the start of 2021. So I'm now going to go through all of my phone photos and print out, say, 30-ish photos of certain moments throughout the year and staple them into the diary so that I can then reflect back on it later on. And it becomes a work of art in some respects that hopefully will bring me or family members joy or insight years into the future. So that's a project that I'm working on.
That's a really good idea, is kind of making it multimedia. Using pictures as a journaling tool is a good idea. Yeah. And Chris, what's your
like Rob, I do keep a record of what happens during the days, and some days are more interesting than others. that's life. It's a great way of keeping a record so that you can find stories in there. If you're looking for story ideas, that's one particular source. The other thing that I do is walk. And that helps in two ways, at least. We'll leave aside all the health benefits and all of that sort of thing. But in terms of storytelling and creativity, first of all, it's an opportunity to mull over stuff that's on my mind, whatever it is I'm trying to develop. I think it's the rhythm of walking somehow helps to pull the threads together and into something that's workable.
I find that being in the shower does that as well.
Even just going for a pee can do it, you know.
or the ideas come at 4 a.m. when you really should be asleep, but instead you get this like mental download and you have to write it down. And my wife's like, "What on earth are you doing?"
is to help you forget. Because once you've made a note, you don't have to remember it. It's there. You've got it. That's really valuable. The other part of it is that as you walk, you often see things that are inspiring. I do occasionally photograph things, usually fungus. It's amazing where fungus grows. And if you wander around Sheffield, and I'm sure it's true in your part of Sheffield, if you keep your eyes peeled, you'll suddenly see some amazing thing growing where it shouldn't be. I always think that's worth a photograph. But Sanderson Weir on the River Don, for example, that's often worth a photograph because sometimes it's under a couple of foot of water, and sometimes the water's hardly getting through at all, you know, and it changes with the seasons and the weather and so on. So those are a couple of the things that I do, and I think it's worth mentioning Megan Macedo, who is a great storyteller. I think Rob might remember her. She calls this process. It's your process. It's your creative process, and it's really important to get hold of what your process is, so that you can practice it. If you don't know what brings inspiration, then inspiration will just come at random intervals, presumably diminishing over the months and years. But if you have a process and you know what the process is and you follow it, then the chances are that you will continue being creative, even when you don't think you're being creative.
And what works for you might not necessarily work for someone else, and that's fine. It's figuring out. just going back to your walking thing, something that I'm a runner. I run quite a lot. But I find that when I'm out walking, I notice things external. I notice the mushrooms. I notice the light. I notice the leaves falling on the floor if it's autumn. When I'm running, I notice things internal. I think about things. I don't notice the leaves and so on. I'm very much focused on, especially if I'm running up a big Sheffield hill, I'm focused on my breath and how tired I am. But it's the internal things that I notice then. So it definitely varies by activity as well, and perhaps by the intensity of the activity. Yeah, perhaps it doesn't have to be running. It could be cycling, or it could be something else that's challenging, I guess.
Yeah, maybe swimming or something, yeah, as well. Yeah. So thank you, Rob, for being our guest today. You've brought some great insights and stories, and yeah, thank you so much. Make sure you go and check out our other podcasts as well, if you've been listening up to this point as well. We've had lots and lots of guests, so you can go and check out those. And Rob, if anyone wants to find out more about you and your book and your courses or whatever your coaching offers are right now, how can they find you?
Yep, so my website is storycopywriters.com. And my book is Simple Story Selling, which you'll either find a link to from the website, or you can go to Amazon and search for either my name, Rob Drummond, or search for Simple Story Selling.
Great.
Yes, I'm still running Telling Stories Making Business, which is an opportunity for any business owner. Locally in Sheffield, we meet at the Island Cafe around a table over sandwiches, and you get a chance to tell a story and get feedback, not just from me, but from a few other business owners as well. And I think it's valuable to get those different views. Or if you don't live in Sheffield, we can do it online at a Zoom meeting. And I try to do a couple of those a month. We've done over 80 now. I think I'm just on the 82nd, I think. they're great fun. And of course, this podcast, my website details and everything else are in the show notes. Gemma?
Yep. Thank you. So, yeah, you can find me on Spotify, iTunes, Amazon Music, YouTube, and I also do Finding Your Voice sessions. You can do that one-on-one or in groups, and various gigs I'm around as well. So just if you follow me on the social medias, Gemma Rosenthal and at creativehearts.coach, and you'll find the various different events coming up. And yeah, you can listen to my music as well. So I've got a new single coming out soon. It's going to be called As a Woman. It's actually a poem set to music. So look out for that one. And Trust the Flow is already out. So
thank
you. Listen to those.
So, well, thank you, Rob. I think we've had a good session, and we're very grateful to you for spending some time with us. So farewell.